How to Survive the Chicxulub Asteroid. Let's say you want to go on a camping trip with warm nights and sunny days, interesting wildlife and bright stars. So you travel back to the very, very late Cretaceous period for a camping trip 66.5 million years ago, back when the climate was so warm, palm trees grew in the Arctic, and the most famous, most fearsome dinosaurs to ever live walked the Earth. You'll see the famous Tyrannosaurus hunting the Triceratops. You'll see the 80-ton Alamosaurus eating leaves 40 feet above the ground. You'll see the tank-like Ankylosaurus crushing opponents with its wrecking ball tail. And just as you settle down on one particular evening, you'll see a brand new star in the northern hemisphere sky. The star won't flash, flare up, or blaze across the horizon. It will appear as stationary and as twinkly as all the others, but look again a few hours later, and you might think this new star seems a little brighter. Look again the next night, and it will be the brightest star in the sky. Then it will outshine the planets. Then the moon. Then the sun. Then it will streak through the atmosphere, strike the Earth, and unleash 100 million times more energy than the largest thermonuclear device ever detonated. The day the Chicxulub asteroid slammed into what is now the small town on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula that bears its name is the most consequential moment in the history of life on our planet. In a prehistoric nanosecond, the reign of the dinosaurs ended and the rise of mammals began. Not only did the impact exterminate every dinosaur save for a few ground-nesting birds, it killed every land mammal larger than a raccoon. In a flash, Earth began one of the most apocalyptic periods in its history. Could you survive it? Maybe. If you make your camp on the right continent, in the right environment, and you seek out the right kind of shelter, at the right altitudes, at the right times, you might stand a chance, says Charles Bardeen, a climate scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, who modeled the asteroid's fallout for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Of course, even if you are on the opposite side of the world at the time of impact, which is the only way you can hope to make it out alive, he recommends you act quickly. As soon as you hear the sonic boom, don't worry, you'll hear it regardless of where you are on the planet, get yourself to high ground and find underground shelter immediately. You might think it's a bit alarmist to duck and cover from the impact of a city-sized rock landing 10,000 miles away. It isn't. But you wouldn't be the first to make the mistake of underestimating an asteroid. The cataclysmic risk posed by asteroids wasn't well understood until World War I. Before then, most astronomers operated under the blissful naivete that massive impacts like Chicxulub were simply not possible. When Galileo trained his telescope on the moon in 1609 and discovered perfectly circular craters dominating its topography, astronomers began to wonder how they formed. A few, like the early 19th century German astronomer Franz von Paula Greuthuysen, proposed asteroid impacts as the cause, but most rejected this theory based upon one simple, supremely confounding fact. The moon's craters are almost perfect circles, and as anyone who has thrown a rock into dirt can tell you, that isn't what an impact scar should look like. Instead, the mark will be oblong, oval, and messy. Greuthuysen probably didn't help his cause by also claiming to have seen cows grazing upon moon grass in these craters. Further misleading any theorists, astronomers could make out little mountains in the center of each depression. Thus, for 300 years, the majority of astronomers and physicists believed at least two facts about our moon. One, cows did not graze upon moon meadows. And two, lunar volcanoes, rather than meteors, had pocked its face. The former fact has thus far held true even under the scrutiny of modern telescopes, but the latter began to falter when a significant difference between large explosions and thrown rocks was revealed in the years prior to World War I. In the early 1900s, astronomers like Russia's Nikolai Alexandrovich Morozov began observing bomb craters and made a rather startling discovery. Large explosions differ from thrown rocks in a number of ways, but most relevantly, at least with regard to our moon's appearance, they leave perfectly circular craters regardless of their angle of impact. As Morozov wrote in 1909, after conducting a series of experiments, asteroid impacts would discard the surrounding dust in all directions regardless of their translational motion in the same way as artillery grenades do in falling on the loose Earth. After Morozov's findings, the moon's craters no longer looked like the benign remains of a remote geologic process, but the circular harbingers of the apocalypse.
Footnote.
Morozov's biography reads a little like the Count of Monte Cristo if you replace revenge with science. He spent 25 years as a political prisoner in a 14th-century castle-turned-prison on a small island outside St. Petersburg, during which time he taught himself 11 languages and published works on everything from the structure of the atom to the geology of the Western Caucasus. Shortly after his release, he turned his attention to astronomy. Even before Morozov's discovery, proponents of the volcanic moon theory, such as Harvard Dean of Science Nathaniel Shaler, were aware that an asteroid impact could be devastating. The fall of a bolide of even 10 miles in diameter would have been sufficient to destroy organic life of the Earth, wrote Shaler in 1903. But most astronomers believed this was an entirely theoretical exercise, partly because, as Shaler noted in his defense of the lunar volcanism theory, the very existence of humanity proved this sort of impact could not have occurred. Morozov's calculations changed that. Once you know the true origins of the scars on the moon, you don't have to be an astronomer or even own a telescope to arrive at the sobering conclusion that asteroid impacts occur with disturbing frequency. Shaler was, in a way, presciently incorrect. An asteroid of nearly the size he described did impact Earth and did wipe out the planet's dominant species. Only, rather than wiping out humans, it cleared the evolutionary path for a shrew-sized placental mammal to eventually crawl, walk, and consider this camping trip to the apocalypse. The survival of your shrew-like ancestor suggests that a fellow mammal like yourself would at least stand a chance. Unfortunately, the shrew had a number of apocalypse-friendly adaptations that humans have since lost. The shrew ate insects, burrowed away from the heat, and had fur to warm itself during the freezing decade that followed. You could replicate some of the shrew's survival strategies. You could burrow and you could expand your diet, but evolution has robbed you of others, and your opposable thumbs might not be enough to save you when that twinkling star enters the atmosphere at around 12.5 miles per second. At impacts of that speed, Earth's atmosphere behaves like water. Smaller rocks, called meteors, hit the atmosphere like pebbles into a pond. They decelerate rapidly at high altitudes, either burning away in their friction with the air or decelerating to their low-altitude terminal velocity. But the mountain-sized Chicxulub asteroid hit our atmosphere like a boulder into a puddle. It maintained its velocity until impact, plunging through the entire 60 miles of atmosphere in around 6 seconds. As the asteroid screeched over what is now Central America, it emitted a sonic boom that reverberated across the continents. It fell so quickly that the air itself could not escape. Under intense compression, the air heated thousands of degrees almost instantly, so that before the asteroid even impacted, much of the shallow sea that covered the Yucatan in the late Cretaceous had already vaporized. Milliseconds later, the rock plunged through what water was left and slammed into bedrock at more than 10 miles per second. In that instant, a few near-simultaneous processes occurred. First, the impacting meteor applied so much pressure to the soil and rock that these neither shattered nor crumbled, but instead flowed like fluids. This effect actually makes it easier to visualize the formation of the crater because the undulations of the Earth almost exactly replicated the double splash of a cannonballer in a backyard swimming pool. The initial splash in all directions was followed by a delayed vertical sploosh when the cavity created by the impactor rebounded to the surface. In a swimming pool, this entire process occurs in a few seconds. In Chicxulub, it took around 10 minutes, but the difference is a function of scale, not speed. The initial wall of Earth gouged outward was more than 20 miles high. The transitory cavity nearly breached Earth's mantle, and when the cavity rebounded to form the delayed vertical sploosh, the Earth rose at over 1,000 miles per hour to heights taller than Mount Everest. Within minutes, this mountain almost entirely collapsed in a series of secondary explosions, but it left behind a smaller mound called a crater's peak ring, which is the formation that so confused those early moon gazers. The very same moment the asteroid first struck the Yucatan and applied its pressure to the bedrock, It also converted the kinetic energy of a 7.5 billion ton rock traveling 10 miles per second into heat in an instant. Why a rock hitting another rock produces heat isn't all that intuitive, but thermodynamically, heat is simply the movement of molecules. The jigglier the molecules, the hotter the temperature. You can jiggle molecules by any number of means, but physically hitting them works, which is why a hammer heats up after you hit a nail. But whereas a hammer swing delivers approximately 0.0001 kilojoules of energy, the Chicxulub impactor delivered approximately 1,300 sextillion. The impact jiggled the molecules of the Earth's rock, soil, and air to temperatures that exceeded the surface of the sun. The heat ripped away electrons from atoms, ionizing the air into an expanding fireball of plasma turbocharged with vaporized rock and blasted out from the impact crater at hypersonic speeds. The heated, rapidly expanding air and near-instantaneous conversion of Earth to gas, combined with the impact shockwave of the meteor itself, to form a massive blast wave of pressure expanding outward at more than 1,000 miles per hour. The only comparable event is a shallow-depth thermonuclear explosion, though depending on their sizes, the energy associated with meteoric impacts can be much greater, says planetary scientist Elizabeth Silber. In this case, the impact was 100 million times greater. If this asteroid hit in the same spot today, the blast wave would kill you in Texas, deafen you in New York, and blow out your window panes in Buenos Aires. The rock rang Earth like a bell. Waves in the Earth's crust radiated away from the impact zone at 2.5 miles per second. These waves then triggered fault-slipping earthquakes across the continents. If you're on the other side of the world, you can expect to feel the ground-shaking effect 30 minutes after impact. Stay away from the banks of any large body of water, where earthquakes may trigger tsunami-like seiche waves in isolated bodies of water, like fjords or lakes. Even more important, stay off the beach. The impact triggered tsunamis, plural, as tall as skyscrapers. The first of them hit Gulf coastlines within the hour. Waves ranging from 600 to 1,000 feet high smashed into what is now Mexico and the southern United States and flooded tens of miles inland. The waves temporarily reversed the flow of rivers, rushing up riverbeds like 30-foot tidal bores. Tsunamis wrapped up the eastern seaboard, smashed into the eastern coast of the United States, and 6 hours after impact, crested as 600-foot-high walls of water in Europe, Africa, and on the Mediterranean coasts. Within 15 hours of impact, waves arrived on every coastline on the planet. These tsunamis deeply complicate your survival strategy because proximity to the coastline is otherwise a good idea in super-large asteroid strikes. The ocean serves as the Earth's great insulator, moderating the severe temperature swings that the massive impacts induce. In the case of Chicxulub, the swing began with heat. When the asteroid punched a hole into Earth's crust, it launched 25 trillion tons of the Yucatan Peninsula on ballistic trajectories. Some of this debris rocketed away at speeds that exceeded our planet's escape velocity, exiting Earth's gravitational pull to either orbit the sun or embed themselves in other moons or planets as meteors themselves. Thousands of these rocks from the ejected Yucatan eventually pelted Mars, and a few even impacted Jupiter's moons, but the majority of the debris returned back to Earth within the hour. These glass-like chunks, called tektites, some as large as school buses, but most the size of marbles, pelted the Earth at speeds ranging from 100 to 200 miles per hour. Regardless of where you are on Earth, you'll need to find protection from this fiery hailstorm. Charles Bardeen suggests a cave. As these glass bullets fell, their friction with the atmosphere collectively emitted enough thermal radiation to set fires across the world. By some estimates, the combined heat of the returning embers was the equivalent of a home oven set to broil. Most of the world's trees burned, which is perhaps why only ground-nesting bird species survived the impact. Of the few larger land animals to avoid extinction, nearly all had some means of escaping the heat. They either could burrow, like small mammals, snakes, and lizards, or escape into water, like crocodiles or turtles. This suggests that even if you're on the other side of the world, you'll need to find protection from the initial heat blast. Bardeen suggests a deep cave. In a final piece of terrible luck for the dinosaurs and you, Chicxulub happened to strike an area rich in oil and sulfur. The impact ejected 100 billion tons of vaporized sulfur and 10,000 Lake Superior's worth of water into the atmosphere, which then condensed into massive storm clouds and fell back as torrents of acid rain. In the higher latitudes, continent-wide snowstorms deposited tens of feet per day. But the global inundation didn't last long because, in addition to water, Chicxulub vaporized and forcefully ejected enough oil to fill 150 football stadiums. This oil then condensed in the stratosphere as a black sooty layer, which covered the Earth like a coat of black paint. Unlike the sulfur and wildfire smoke, this carbon layer circulated high above the clouds, preventing rain from wicking it clean. So while rain cleared the immense plumes of wildfire smoke from the atmosphere after a few weeks, the soot layer persisted, reducing the amount of sunlight that reached the Earth's surface by 90% for at least 3 years and dropping the planet into a deep, prolonged freeze. Global temperatures fell by an average of almost 50 degrees. The only places you can go to avoid this global freeze are the tropical islands of Madagascar, India, at the time an island, and Indonesia. Not only do these equatorial oases provide a few plants and animals to eat, but according to climate models, they are some of the few places on Earth that continued to receive fresh water. In the global chill, evaporation almost ceased, and rainfall decreased by 80%. Nearly every spot on Earth outside of these tropical islands dried into a desert. These islands might be an apocalyptic oasis, but they are no paradise. Skip the sunscreen and pack extra food. They receive 10% of their normal sunlight and only barely enough rainfall to stay above desertification. In this cold, dim environment, most, but not all, food chains will collapse. Fossil evidence suggests freshwater ecosystems fared among the best, so forage near rivers or estuaries. There, you may find turtles, crocodiles, and some fish to eat. Sediment-living animals, such as clams, snails, and small crustaceans, also do quite well in the post-impact environment. Still, Bardeen warns against any trips by the ill-prepared. To survive, you would have to bring something to keep you warm and at least 6 years of food supply to stand any chance, he says. But if you cannot be dissuaded, then at least find a mountainous tropical island. There, you'll find a tolerable temperature and at least a little rain. You'll find shelter from the rain of tektites, the searing heat, and perhaps something to eat in the rivers and lakes. Just spare any shrew-like creatures you may find in your desperate search for food. It's unclear how many survived the Chicxulub impact, so eating the wrong one could result in some rather catastrophic consequences for the rest of humanity.